Quoi?
Då, ja, man blir ju nästan lite starstruck då nu efter den här föreläsningen som han hade här.
Precis. Nu, vi sitter och laddar upp här. Vi ska träffa
Doug. Master Judge.
Precis.
Så han har precis då anordnat en sån här BCP-exam, alltså domarexamina. Den praktiska delen har han roddat i här i under Hombrokan här. Så vi ska träffa honom precis efter han har haft det här examinationen här med.
Får vi se vad vi ska prata med honom om.
Ja. Vi tänker väl att vi ska prata lite om homebrewing clubs. Liksom. Det verkar ju vara en stor grej här i USA.
Ja, precis. Jag har något som kanske inte riktigt. Jag har lite svårt att fatta lite vad det innebär. Eller, och ja. Så det ska bli spännande att se.
Det börjar väl poppa upp, eller det finns väl sedan tidigare också lite sånt i Sverige med. Men sen så ska vi väl försöka, i och med att han hade en så pass intressant seminarie, så ska vi väl försöka återkoppla till det lite.
Lite det, och det blir också spännande att se, höra lite smått och gott om, jag menar, kanske kvaliteten på öl bland hembryggare. I och med att han är domare så är jag med och dömer liksom, kanske lite vad som är vanligaste felen bland amerikanska hembryggare och sånt. Det blir nog spännande, tror jag.
Ja, det vi får springa nu, det är dags.
Stick dit.
Let's go.
Halleluja!
Great. Then we are sitting here with Doug and Benjamin from Quaff. You say it like that?
Quaff.
Yes. Yeah. Quaff. Yeah. What's that? What does Quaff stand for? I guess it's what we say, förkortning.
Yeah. Yeah, Quaff
an
is
an acronym.
It used to be an acronym, yeah, but it also is a word that just means to drink or drink heartily. So,
all right.
A few years ago, we dropped the acronym and just shortened it to just Quaff.
All right. So,
Yeah. Quaffable beer.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So you are not only beer drinkers, you are also homebrewers, I guess.
Homebrewers. Yeah. We're judges, but we also enjoy meads and ciders as well. Yeah.
But is Quaff, that's a home brewing club, or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we actually have members that are professionals. But the bulk of us are regular work a day that have it as a hobby.
Yeah.
Okay. And Ben, you are the current president?
I am the current president, yes.
Yeah. And Doug, you are an ex-president.
I'm the immediate past president. I was the president before Ben, yeah.
Okay. And how many members are in Quaff?
Right now we have about 280.
Whoa.
Wow.
280 paid members for this year so far.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
You know the names, or do you have like a meeting place where you meet up? But you have to be a big, huge place if you meet up all at once.
Yeah, I probably know 200 of them.
Yeah.
We have a meeting once a month on the fourth Tuesday of the month, and it's typically these days about 80 to 90 people that attend. And some of our members live outside of San Diego. Some of them live in other states. We have one, I think, Roland, I think he's in Europe right now. So we've had some members who used to be in San Diego and then they've left, but they still be a part of the club remotely.
Okay. So what do you do on a typical such meeting?
Typical meeting, we have announcements, upcoming events, where we talk about activities that the club is doing. We always have a featured speaker that's usually about 45 to 50 minutes, sort of like the seminars here at the conference. And they'll talk about anything ranging from a style or history or brewing technique or food pairing or something that similar to a seminar at HomebrewCon that will be of interest. And we have announcements, results from internal club competitions or awards that people receive that we announce. And then we always have a section at the end for what we call Brewer's Corner, where people can ask questions and then anyone in the audience who knows the answer can help out, because we find that a lot of times you run into something that maybe seems really strange or puzzling and you can't figure out why it happened, but with a club as large as ours, there's a good chance that somebody else has had the same issue before. So that works really well. And then we have shameless plugs at the end where people give announcements about upcoming events or activities outside of the club that they want people to know about.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that because as a beginner, you get so many questions when you start. You know, it got to be really good for beginners to have a club or member to fall back on when you have run into issues. I guess because that's one of my what I think that beginners are. It's a hobby that creates a lot of questions.
When you are reading about things on the internet and stuff, and sometimes it just gets harder to understand. But when you talk to someone, it's something totally
absolutely,
different.
Absolutely. Yeah, we do. We'll also do many people will bring beers, meads, and ciders to share.
Yep.
So we've kind of made it a point to have a time slot to where they can get up and talk about it, the process, and then a little Q&A as we pour the beers for the people in the crowd. So it's a good interaction. And we get a good variety of styles that people approach and things like that. And one of the bigger things that, you know, I think has been a real success is Doug had the idea a few years ago after the pandemic to create a mentorship program with more experienced members, with newer members, and strengths and weaknesses and things like that, to where it encourages the newer people to interact and learn and have questions. And then, of course, you get to know, you know, people that you might not. So it builds bonds on a more personal level than just a 100-150 person meeting.
Yeah, that sounds
very interesting.
Yeah, it sounds great because it's in many times it's you know, the home brewing is, I like to brew myself. I don't like to brew with people.
Honestly, I don't either.
No. But I still think that it's a social hobby, homebrewing, and making this is making it even more like a social hobby. You meet other brewers because, to be honest, it's only other brewers that know what you go through with your beer. You know, the passion you put down and understand is, and sometimes it's hard, I think, for many Swedish brewers who are, you know, brewing by themselves, and they give it to their wife or their dad and they say, this is really good, but what's the ABV? That's the most common question. Yeah.
And I think there is some validity to the point brought up a little earlier about, you know, you could see it online on YouTube or read about it, but that doesn't put it into context. That doesn't give you the full aroma or flavor. You know, when you're sitting there, we were just, Doug just administered an exam and we were helping out, and we would sample the same things that the students were sampling. Mm-hmm. And we each, you know, we're kind of spitballing ideas on what we thought was that we perceived. And it's a good way it's a great way to learn. And then, of course, if there are flaws, how do you correct them and things like that?
Yeah.
So have you seen any now during or after the pandemic, maybe? Have you seen how has that affected the club? Has it been any, we've seen at least in Sweden, in a lot of clubs, I mean, in different sports and stuff, a decline in memberships and activities. Is that something that you have?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, and this is affected QAF. Our membership was well over 300, probably more like 340 or 350 before the pandemic. And it cut across, as you mentioned, other clubs, activities, sports, anything that people do that you talk to. It seems like the numbers are down. And even for this conference this year, I think they had lower registration, fewer people entering the competition. And for what, you know, I think a lot of people fell out of habits during the pandemic and maybe fell into a bit of a funk. And it's just hard to snap out of that and get back into things you were doing. And other times, maybe people reexamined their priorities and said, I'm doing this thing, but is it really bringing me joy? And focus on a smaller number of things that are bringing me more joy. I don't know. But we've definitely noticed, we made a very strong effort throughout the pandemic to try to keep people engaged. We had virtual meetings once a month instead of in person. And we still organized competitions within the club that we could, in a safe way, get people together to judge. It was usually like, you know, two people in a room and then two people in another room to minimize potential exposure, and is anything that we could think of during the pandemic to try to keep people engaged, because we knew that, you know, during a lockdown situation, you can lose touch and it's harder to build those connections again than it is to destroy them, or not even actively destroy, but just have them sort of passively wilt. So we've definitely noticed that, but I think we, in the last 6 to 9 months, have seen sort of a resurgence of enthusiasm. I think as we fall a little more into a normal calendar, I think for us, having HomebrewCon here in San Diego was something that for the last year we've been really focused as a club on trying to make sure we make the best impression and really try to rally everyone to get their best beers ready for the competition. And that helps build some esprit de corps. And that's been helpful. So I've perceived a bit of an enthusiasm increase over the last 6 or 9 months. But, you know, a year and a half ago, things were definitely kind of at a bottom.
Yeah. But you didn't notice like a rise of homebrewers during the pandemic? I know that in Sweden it was a ridiculous amount of people that picked up homebrewing, like as a new hobby or like revisited their old hobby.
So in the U.S., the thing that people picked up during the pandemic like that was sourdough bread making. I don't know why.
In
everybody
as well.
And
in
their
Sweden
brother
well.
Was yeah. making sourdough
they
bread.
They have chickens now.
You know, homebrew in general, also interest in homebrew in the U.S. has been on a decline, and that preceded the pandemic by a couple of years. So the peak for homebrew interest in the U.S., and I don't have economic data, but intuitively it was probably around 2016 to 2018, somewhere in that window, maybe 2017. So even before the pandemic, the numbers were starting to recede. And I think a lot of that, I think the age cohort that was sort of leading the homebrew charge in the aughts and the teens has aged up a little bit. More of those people have kids. They're in their 40s, some into their 50s. And a lot of those people are still brewing, maybe a little less than they were. But for whatever reason, younger people in the U.S., 20-somethings, haven't picked up homebrew as much. And part of it may be the advent of these alternative alcoholic beverages, seltzer and hard kombucha and coconut water. And those things are more popular with the young people than they were with my cohort. And if you're not drinking beer, it's hard to get excited about making beer. Mm. And it also may just be, I don't know if it's like this in Sweden, but in the U.S., I think a lot of times a generation, whatever the generation ahead of them was doing, isn't cool.
Yeah.
And so maybe the Gen Z and even some late millennials will look at what Gen X and the early millennials are doing and say, well, that's what those guys do. It's not so cool anymore. So when we get old enough that we're out of the picture, maybe more young people will think it's cool again.
Yeah. It was a reflection that we made today during your seminar when we entered and saw the other participants, that it's in Sweden the community is much, much younger, the mean age of people do in because we were at the Swedish homebrewing
conference
championship a few months ago, and it's, I would say, it's like 20 years younger in average.
Yeah. But at the same time, the hobby is 20 years younger in Sweden than it is in the U.S. as well.
The
whole craft beer movement is like 20 years younger in one aspect. So I don't know if that's cohort, but I agree that, you know, the people in brewing, the typical home brewer in Sweden is like us, like in the 30 and 40,
maybe.
Well, and the last time that this conference was in San Diego was in 2015, so 8 years ago. And if you had come to this conference 8 years ago and looked at the average age in a seminar, I wouldn't be surprised if the average age was 5 years younger than it is today. Like a lot of the people that were there today are the same people that have just aged by 8 years, but they haven't been replenished by a younger crowd as much.
Yeah. With regard to COVID, it seemed like some folks had the spare time early on, so then they got busy brewing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long that lasted. It seems that kind of dwindled after, you know, 4 or 5 months, and then it kind of went back to normal.
Yeah.
And then, of course, things opened back up and normalcy kicked in.
Well, and in the U.S. too, most homebrewers, the typical batch is 5 gallons. And I don't know if that's the same size that people typically brew in Sweden, but if you're, you know, locked down and not seeing your friends, for a lot of people, 5 gallons is a decent bit of beer to consume by yourself or in your household.
Yeah.
And if you don't have meetings to take your beer to or friends coming over to drink your beer, you know, you brew a couple times and all of a sudden you have 5 months worth of beer on hand. Yeah. You don't need to brew again until six months later. No.
Well, I guess all three of us are mostly doing like 3 gallon batches
today. Yeah. I have the possibility to brew bigger batches, but I'm one of those that I like brewing more than drinking, and I like to drink beer. So I really like to, I think I'm in that camp.
I really like
the process. So I come to the conclusion that, you know, 3 gallons is perfect because then I get to brew more.
What's the typical approach? Are you bottle conditioning or are you just going all CO2?
I do a little bit of both.
Cool. Depends on the style, I guess.
Exactly. Okay. For the yeast-driven beers, I always referment in the bottle.
Excellent.
But not my lager beers and the hoppy beers, I would say. No.
Same here.
Yeah.
I guess you are quite fond of the idea of doing both, I guess.
Yeah, you spun it to a certain degree. I learned from Duvel, you know,
the devil.
It's a hell of a beer, but they do force carb to 2.5 volumes, and then they also referment on top of that, so they cap on foam. When they bottle with new yeast and re-yeast it, for me that's when I heard about that, it was like an eye opener. Mm-hmm. But that's what's, you know, it's like best of both worlds in one way to keep out oxygen. And
Sierra Nevada does a similar thing. Carb up to almost the final level, and then at bottling time they insert just a small amount of sugar in yeast so that it's there to basically scavenge oxygen and finish the deal.
Yeah. Now that's. I think there's been the most recent like game changer in my process has been that approach.
What kind of beers do you guys enjoy to brew and drink?
I brew a lot of Bavarian lagers. Mm. I love brewing Schwarzbier, Helles, Munich Dunkel. Recently started doing a Vienna lager, Doppelbock. But I also like brewing American ales, and particularly West Coast IPA. I have an American amber ale that I brew. I would like to start brewing more American porters and stouts. I think that's probably going to be the next thing that I get into, just because these days when I go out, I find myself reaching for those often, and I enjoy drinking them. But American blonde, cream ale, and I occasionally brew British and Belgian things. I think there's more process about those styles that I'm less familiar with, and it's harder for me to really nail the character that I want. So I stick with the German lagers and American ales.
Yeah, I've kind of been all over the map lately. I did a nice Doppelbock. I've just bottled up German Pils. We're doing this collab. So Jeff and I did a Czech Premium Pils. I have a Märzen. I've been doing some Belgians. I did a Trappist Single, a Belgian Pale, a couple wacky Saisons. I got a... I split a batch. I did a Rogan beer and then took half of it and did a rye saison with South African hops and put some bread on it.
All right.
So
that's crazy.
I think that'll be pretty awesome in a couple months. Yeah. So for me, you know, a little bit of this, the club competitions we have is a little motivator to get off, you know, get off the couch and get creative again.
Yeah.
Of course, work and life gets in the way. Yeah. But kind of doing some of these styles that I don't usually make, I find it interesting because then you delve into the style and learn more about it and, you know, move on to something else. I also did a pale and an IPA with some of these South African hops that was one of the concepts.
All right. And what about for tomorrow? Tomorrow is... The club night is that like one of the big happenings, I guess, at HomebrewCon.
That's the biggest happening.
It's the biggest happening. And what can you like explain club night for us rookies, first timers here in
So a bunch of clubs, particularly from the West Coast, because it's easier for us to bring things here. Rally the troops and ask people, you know, bring your finest, bring your best beer, put it in kegs, and we're going to have bars set up. These clubs have bars that they travel with. They bring them down, and you're going to go around from club to club, from booth to booth, and taste their beers. and it's
so you get to meet, basically you get a huge to meet beer the brewer,
and
chat and ask questions, and then of course they get to explain and be proud of what they're serving.
It's a beer fest for homebrew.
Yeah, sounds great. Is it only for joy, like, or is there any voting included? Or
no, anything? It's purely social.
Yeah, purely social.
And it's always a great time because sometimes if you've come to the conference multiple times, you see people that you see once a year from other parts of the country and connect with them, and everybody's well lubricated and usually on very delicious things because people bring the stuff they want to show off, and they bring some really cool stuff and things that you would normally not try, things that commercial breweries aren't brewing because they're afraid it's not going to sell to the masses or whatever.
Or it might cost too much.
Might cost too much. Yeah.
So how many beers do you think we can suspect on that?
Hundreds.
So we have between the social hour today and tomorrow, we have 53 minimum.
Right. Our club has 53 kegs.
Yeah, all right. For just our club. All right. So,
but we'll have 20 at a time. At homebrew club night tomorrow, we'll only be able to serve 20 at a time because we're limited by taps. So we'll rotate the kegs in and out.
Right.
And I think there's going to be, what, 20 or so
Those
clubs,
guys 15? Said that he just brought down 25 kegs.
Doe's brought 20 kegs. And the Falcons, I'm sure, brought a bunch of kegs.
And there'll be a bunch of bottles.
The Barley
to
Engineers are going to have a bunch of kegs. They're going to have a bunch of sours because they also make a ton of European sours.
All right.
Are we going to drink them all, right?
Yeah, of course. Or is it more like, because we at the Swedish homebrewing, we have the same that, well, you know, homebrewers bring their kegs and they serve it in usually they're all like...
But more as individuals.
It's not clubs, it's like persons, you know, the brewers. It's the same because it's like a big family meeting. Once in a year, you meet that brewer from the northern part of Sweden that you met. So for me, it's a really important happening because, you know, once in a year, I get to meet these guys. But is there a lot of, there's no competition in all of this, but is there like unofficial competition to bring the best beers amongst the...
bragging rights.
You definitely want to make a good impression. We strongly encourage people, if you have something you have questions about, let some of the folks in the club who are experienced judges taste it and give you an opinion on whether it's up to... Because look, you know, we're a club that has a bit of a reputation. We've won National Homebrew Club of the Year nine times.
Yeah.
And that puts a bit of a bullseye on your back. If somebody comes to Quaff and they get a beer that's not up to par, they go back and tell their friends, oh, those Quaff guys aren't shit. I had their beer. It was pretty mediocre. It was not good.
It's like a burned racing car.
Every brewer has a bad day, but yeah, you definitely want to show your best. But there's nobody organizes any kind of competition. And, you know, maybe you go and see a club you've never heard of and a beer really makes a positive note on you. And all of a sudden you say, oh man, like those guys know how to brew because this guy at club night had this incredible cider that just blew my mind. And all of a sudden, like, you'll remember that club for years.
And
you'll tell people about it. Yeah. So you want people to be talking about your beer. You want people to say, oh, you need to go over to Quaff and try this smoked Helles that Ben Freimark made because, man, it's really special. And then there's a line. If there's anything close to an unofficial competition, it's just people's egos exploding if they see a line at the tap. You know, if your club has a line, that's usually a good sign.
Yeah, in one way I like this competition thing, but also in one way it's good with this without competition. Then you can serve. There is some beers, you know, that this beer will never win a competition, and then you don't serve it maybe. But we talked about mild before; that could be one example. But in such thing like this, then you can serve those beers also more.
And Homebrew Club of the Year prize awarded? Is that the most ribbons from the members from the Homebrew Club, or
that's a points system? It's based on the National Homebrew Competition that was judged yesterday.
Yeah,
and when people enter the competition, they have the option to designate a club that they're a part of.
Yeah.
You can designate one club. So if you're in multiple clubs, you have to choose one.
Yeah.
And if somebody from that club gets a first place, a gold medal, that's worth 7 points. A silver is worth 6, and a bronze is worth 5.
All right.
Fourth place is worth nothing. So they add up all those points, and whatever club had the most points, and that's from all the beer and mead and cider categories.
Okay.
And these days, it's become very challenging because it used to be that you got points for beers from the first round, because the National Homebrew Competition is a two-stage competition. You have regional first round, and then you have a second round. And it used to be that you accumulated some points for the first round, and then you could accumulate additional in the second round. But they've eliminated the first round points because that was giving a big advantage to the large clubs that had huge numbers of entrants. Because they would accumulate a massive margin in the first round, and then no one could catch them. Yeah. So they nerfed the first round, and it's only second round. But the challenge now is, you know, the club that wins Homebrew Club of the Year may have 5 medals that year. Yeah. Or 4 medals that year. Like, it's very challenging now to win a second round medal just because there's so many entrants and there's so much good stuff,
spread out,
particularly
right?
in the beer categories. Yeah. 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 You know, you may have over 200 entries in a certain category. Yeah. And so even if you submit something that's just amazing, it's still a large bit of a crapshoot. So it's definitely made, from our perspective, it much more challenging to win Homebrew Club of the Year, but we're trying to give it everything we got.
Especially this year when a bunch of Scandinavians sent in beers.
Come in, you know, and make a better Spokellos than I do.
Sweden is taking all the medals with the Lichtenhainer and Spokellos.
It's like the Russian gymnasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but for us it was like we didn't really had high expectations that we would go to the final round, but we felt that it would be extra nice, like creaming on top of the cake, if we actually could get one beer to the final round. So, but it was fun because we had at least one each to the final round.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
Yeah.
So you got,
and it's a motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
So next year, you know, get twice as many.
We'll see.
Yeah, let's see.
And most of these categories, second round, there were 9 first round sites. And in most categories, 3 things advanced, with a few exceptions. Sometimes they passed less than 3. Occasionally, there was an admin pass for more than 3. So most of these second round categories had 27.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do that, you got 3 shots, and each of them has maybe, you know, if it was a purely blind thing, which it isn't because there's quality involved, but if it was purely random, it's purely blind, but not purely random. You know, 3 out of 27, 1 in 9. And if your stuff is better than average, it's better than 1 in 9. So your fingers crossed.
Yeah. Time will tell.
Time will tell.
So Doug, we this morning you gave a seminar on mash.
Mastering the mash. Mastering or practicing the mash.
Yes. Practicing doesn't have the same alliterative effect as mastering. So I'll stick with mastering the mash. But yeah, it's. We need to have some humility about it, because the mash is a very complicated process that we can try to abstract away and try to control as best as possible, but there's a lot going on that we obviously don't see with our eyeballs, and our puny human brains can't really fathom all these, you know, reactions that are happening at a microscopic level.
And it was a really interesting seminar. You did 150 mashes.
I did 19 sets of trials.
Yeah,
and 17 of those trials had 8 mashes, and 2 of them had 7. So you multiply it out, it ended up being 150 mashes in the span of 27 days, 4 weeks.
And they were mini mashes.
They were mini mashes. Yeah. They were 60, most of them, with the exception of some of the thickness trials, they were 64 grams of malt and 200 milliliters of liquor.
Yeah. And so then you tried to compare different temperatures for the mashing, and you compared. You did one trial where you added different degrees of caramel malt, and you tried different mash thicknesses and pH, and it was really interesting. And I guess one of the things that we took away from that seminar is something that we already are advocates for, but it was nice to see, like, the empirical study that you made, that the mash pH should be higher than, like, the common perception is that you should always mash at 5.2. It has been like the truth
back
for
in
several
days,
years.
Yeah.
But at least we started mashing around 5.5 for most beers, and then lower the pH in the end of the boil.
Exactly. That's one of the takeaways I had. And I'm glad you mentioned about in the boil too, because, you know, there's multiple steps in the process where you can adjust the pH. And so you can set your pH for your mash at one thing, But if that leads to a kettle pH that's higher than you want, you can just add additional acid in the kettle and still end up with the kettle pH or the going into the final wort pH that you want. So for me, that was a takeaway. I have been aiming for 5.2 to 5.25 for my mashes, and I have had some beers where they've finished two or three ticks, you know, gravity points higher than I thought maybe they should. And I think I probably should be mashing closer to 5.5 or 5.45 at least for a beta rest. And that's something I'm going to do. But I'm going to compensate for it by adding additional acid in the kettle, because I really like the acidity level in the final beers. And I like the way the yeast is behaving with that final wort pH. But I can just add that acid in the kettle instead of adding it in the mash. But it's a challenge. I think there's been one of the things that's happened in kind of intermediate to advanced home brewing over the last 10 years is a lot of people have gone to using reverse osmosis water, because they realize that what comes out of the tap is variable. You can't control it. It's also difficult, at least in San Diego, for us to remove all the chloramine from the water. Chlorine is easy. Chloramine is a lot more challenging to remove. It just requires really careful carbon filtration. And so a lot of people have just sort of sidestepped these issues by going to RO and building up their water. But if you're an RO brewer, which a lot of us now are, it's difficult to get sufficient alkalinity in your water in order to have a higher mash pH, particularly if you're brewing darker beers where that malt is very acidic. So I'm going to have to look into some techniques, maybe adding some slaked lime, because there's only so much baking soda you can add before it starts tasting salty, and chalk doesn't dissolve well.
Any other big takeaways you think we should have noticed from your seminar?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway is just to really try to think, be thoughtful when you're designing the mash. And by that, I mean, think about your time, your temperature, your mill gap setting, your thickness, your grist composition, your pH. Think of all of that holistically, because you may have constraints on one of those things. You may have a certain grist that you need to use because you're doing a certain style, and that's going to result in 20% of your grist being caramel or roasted malts with no diastatic power. But you may also have your pH maybe lower than you want or need, because you may have a lot of dark grains, and it may just not be possible, or you don't want the profile of adding that much alkalinity to your water. And to think holistically, you know, how to compensate for those things. In the example I gave, maybe you would go with a thicker mash where it would sort of insulate the enzymes better and give you more enzymatic activity for a longer duration. And then you would stretch out the time of your mash and maybe mash at a cooler temperature. You know, maybe pick a temperature 149 or below if you're trying to achieve a given attenuation, a dry or an off-dry beer, so that your beta amylase doesn't get denatured, has long enough to do its job. So I don't know that there's any specific, you know, the studies that I did, they were empirical, but I wouldn't necessarily say they were scientific, just because they haven't been replicated, and they would need replication, which I may do. I'll probably return to this at some point and see if I can repeat some of these results and make some new conclusions. But a lot of it was sort of a proof of concept. And anybody in Sweden or wherever, if you have access to an immersion chiller or cooker or sous vide, and you get some breast milk bags, you can do these trials yourself. And if you don't have a Herm system or a RIM system like I do, you can do them in like a thermos and experience that temperature drop that occurs over the course of an hour, just like you would in a cooler, however you're mashing. Because I think a lot of homebrewers have that question too of, well, my mash started at 152 and it finished at 147. So what does that mean? Well, you can do that trial on your benchtop and you can see what does that mean. And then you can do that trial starting at 155. And I'm now using Fahrenheit with a bunch of Europeans. So that'd be like 61 and a half Celsius or 63 Celsius. Yeah. You know, repeat that trial now at 63 Celsius and see how it's different and get an idea, you know, for your system, what parameters are the best to give you what you want. And we talk about this like, you know, more attenuation is better. And that isn't necessarily always the case either. There are certain styles or certain profiles that you may be trying to achieve where you want something that finishes sweeter. And if that's the case, there's lots of ways to do it.
Yeah, I can just mention that if the people that are listening are members of AHA, American Homebrewers Association, it's easy to become a member. Then you can access your seminar online.
Yeah, it'll probably take a couple months for them to get those up there. And, you know, I tried to look out today to see. I didn't see a video camera, but maybe it's just an audio recording. In years past, they've done both. Sometimes it's just audio with slides, and sometimes they have a full video. Hopefully my face isn't on there. But one way or another, the words and the slides will be available.
Okay, so we're getting poured a lemon lime Hefeweizen here. Okay.
Ernie Hedelberg. He calls it his Margarita Hef. It's lemon lime.
You said it was old, but I can still feel the esters, the banana.
Oh, this one's pretty fresh.
Okay,
this one's pretty fresh. The one before. Yeah.
So this was entered at the exam as a regular.
I'm sorry. This was entered as to the exam as a regular Hefeweizen.
All right. Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's a little bit of a twist. Okay.
Yeah, but I feel it in the taste that there's something else going on.
Something citrus.
Yeah.
something limey.
Disturb the Germans.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, this is definitely not Reinheits Gebot. Not Reinheits Gebot. Not very many American brewers follow the Reinheits Gebot.
Very fresh. And
A little bit more of like a cocktail, like you said.
Yeah.
Margarita.
Super refreshing.
Yeah.
Really good. But did he add lemon peel? So do you know how he...
I think he used... limeade, simply like lime juice.
All right, yeah,
like
yeah.
like a lemon lime drink, like orange juice.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're talking about you because before we met today here, you had a exam for aspiring BJCP judges.
Yeah. So here at the conference, BJCP tries to sponsor a variety of the exams, and Doug was the administrator for the beer tasting exam.
Okay. And when you serve the beers, does all beers have a flaw, or is it...
Yeah, so the directions that we get from the BJCP, which make perfect sense, are they want for the beers on the exam to be along the lines of what people would encounter in a homebrew competition. So for today's exam, all six beers were beers that were homebrewed by members of our club. It's actually what we've been sitting here drinking during this podcast. And... all of them were as they occurred in the wild, with only two exceptions. One is the lemon lime Hef that he actually did dose with the lemon and lime deliberately because that's what he was trying to achieve, although that's not obviously characteristic for a Hefeweizen. And then the other one that was modified was the double IPA that we had just preceding this, that I added two sugar tablets to each bottle when I bottled it up so it was a little more sweet, had some raw sugar character. But otherwise... they don't necessarily say they want like egregious flaws. You're not trying to hit somebody over the head with diacetyl to see if they get diacetyl. But if the beer has a little diacetyl, that's fine because that's the sort of thing you might encounter in a homebrew comp. And today we had a beer that was thin and watery. It was a third running mild. And we have this Hefeweizen that's, you know, lemon lime, and that's about to style. And we had that double IPA that was a little sweet. And we had a Belgian blonde that was over a year old, so it was a little oxidized. And again, those are the kind of things you encounter in a homebrew competition.
But do you tell the participants that this is a Hefeweizen?
That's all you tell them.
All we tell them is the style.
All right. All right.
Yeah. And we don't even, we tell them this is what you're judging it as. Mm. You'd tell me if it's a proper Hefeweizen, correct. But you're judging this as if it's a Hefeweizen. Right. And if it's not to style, then that's on you.
Do they have the guidelines in front of them?
No. So okay. It'll be six samples in an hour and a half, and they're just simply told what to judge it as, what category.
Okay.
And subcategory to judge it as.
Right.
So there's typically, as an administrator, they try to plan to have a few that are very good score-wise, a few in the middle, and probably a few that have remaining two have significant flaws. Just the challenge. And then the styles should vary for a little bit of a spectrum.
Yeah. Ideally, sample. You get some things that are light, some things that are dark, some things that are strong, some things that are light. You get some things that are German, Belgian, British, American. You get something that's a, German wheat beer because that's a very different characteristic, something Belgian. So you try to pick an array of six beers that's going to check all those boxes.
So they have to memorize all those guidelines.
Well, they need to be familiar. They don't need to go by memory and say, well... the guidelines say medium high to high carbonation, and this is only medium. But if you have a sense that a style should have elevated carbonation and it's not there, then you need to point that out.
And as
As judges here in the US, do you have a feeling of, you know, the most common flaw in homebrews?
Yeah, oxidation is probably one of the biggest imbalance. Beers being out of balance, and it could be out of balance for style or just out of balance for drinkability or both, but that's a very common thing. And then another thing that we run into, you know, diacetyl I think was more common 8 or 9 years ago. I don't encounter much diacetyl. I think most American homebrewers have really dialed in their fermentation.
It was at my table yesterday.
Oh yeah. I mean, it still shows up from time to time, but you don't get nearly as much D and acetaldehyde and fusels as you used to. And I think there's more products available to homebrewers to control their fermentation temp, and people are more aware of doing starters. The other one that you see quite a bit, at least here in San Diego, is chlorophenols. As I mentioned before, it's very difficult to eradicate all the chloramine from the water here.
And yeah, it's got to be difficult to brew with that. When we don't have much chlorine in the water at all in Sweden. I don't know if we have any at all.
No. So the water here is...
But when we drink the water here, we can... We can't almost drink the water.
Because it tastes chlorinated.
Yeah. So, of course, and if you brew on that water, it will be tasting that.
Yeah, if we tried your water, it would probably taste like earthy or something, or really soft because, minerally. But, yeah, the chlorine-chloramine issue is one. And the problem that people have with it is everyone – they know that the way to deal with that is to run your water through a carbon block. And so then they run their water through a carbon block and they tell themselves, okay, well, I did that. I'm good to go. And what they don't realize is with chlorophenols, even you can remove 95% of the chloramine, but if that 5%, even 2% is left, it's going to leave a mark on the beer. And they may not be sensitive enough to chlorophenols to know what it is, but there's going to be something that's unpleasant, particularly in bitter beers because it interacts with bitterness. And there's going to be something there that unless you're really tuned into it, it might be hard to dissect what the problem is. But you're going to get that just that little hint, usually in the finish, of like jacuzzi water, spa water.
And that'll plastic-y, throw off the balance.
And throw off the balance. It's going to make that bitterness harsh. And that's somebody who did a carbon block. They followed the instructions. They might have removed 96% of the chloramine, but that little 4% that's left screwed up their beer. So that's
a
tough
brew day and everything.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it could still maybe be a 30-point beer, but it's never going to be exceptional as long as it's got that chlorophenolic note.
And but do homebrewers need to like buy their own RO filters, or do they go to the store and buy jugs of water?
Most people buy it at the store. Yeah. I have a filter at home. I came to HomebrewCon. This was probably, it was either Baltimore or Portland. So it was either 2016 or 2017. There was a company called H Brew O, and they have a little plastic suitcase, maybe about a foot by a foot by 3 or 4 inches. So make that metric like 0.3 meter, and I don't know, what's that, 10 centimeters. Yep. And it's got a little RO thing in it. And I was like, you know, I did the math. It's like $250. I'm paying 40 cents a gallon for this RO. In 9 months, it'll pay for itself. So I bought the thing, and this was, you know, 6 years ago. It's paid for itself many times over.
Okay.
So I make the RO at home because for 40 cents a gallon, I was saving money. And I used to have to plan my brew day around like when I could go to the homebrew store and or not the homebrew store, the RO water store, and remember to get the water. So some of us have the RO at home, but most people, I think, just go to the store.
Yep. Is water like in San Diego or in US in general, is that like the biggest challenge when it comes to the ingredients of the beer to have like good quality?
Yeah, we're lucky in the US that we have access to really amazing New World hops.
Yeah.
And we have access to great, you know, North American barley. Most of it comes from the US and Canada. I think the water really varies. If you're in some place like Florida or South Carolina where I grew up, the water is extremely soft. If you're out here in San Diego, our water is actually quite hard. People have theorized that that's why San Diego became like a big IPA epicenter because the hard water. I don't know. I think some of that's lore. But the regional differences in the water do make it so that it's very – you have to sort of know your own water and how to deal with it. And for us, the chlorine, chloramine. But if you're somewhere where they don't use chloramine, they only use chlorine, then it's a very easy thing. I think the harder thing for us is – some of the European ingredients. And I think it's kind of a twofold problem. One is access. We can get Weirmann malts, although they're not as available as like a lot of the North American malts. We can get Chateau. You can sometimes get Dingemans.
They might be expensive.
But they might be expensive. Mm. They might be limited. But the other thing is sort of convincing homebrewers that they should use those things.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't chalk it up to like American arrogance, but maybe sort of just an ignorance of the fact that like this malt that's grown in North America, the barley that's grown in North America is different than the barley that's grown in Europe. There's going to be terroir, and a beer that you brew with the Weyermann Pilsner is going to be different than a beer that you brew with Great Western Two Row. And I think a lot of homebrewers in the U.S., they may say, well, the Great Western Two Row is $1.29 a pound and the Weyermann is $2.29 a pound, so why spend that extra dollar? And so sometimes you have to sort of convince them that in the right situation, those European ingredients are actually better than the American ingredients, and you should
spend
the money.
And on the homebrew level, I think we were able to do that because Jeff and I just did – we used the Barque Pils.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, $3 a pound. Yeah. You know.
But you'll have
– it turned out well, and it was for a special – couple special brews. But you'll have – it's definitely different. It stands out.
That's a big favorite of mine.
Yeah.
It's hard to find here. The Barque Pils is – I have never actually used it because it's harder to find. You have to mail order it usually.
So we did. We did a split batch. We did I think he called it Barque at the Moon, and I did Kids in the Holler Tower because I did a German Pils with it. With Holler Tower. You guys don't get – there was a – comedy
Kids
show
in the Hall was in the 90s.
Canada, called Kids in the Hall.
It would get canceled today. It would get very canceled today.
Right. It was my favorite show back in the early.
We would say it's not politically correct.
No.
You know, you'll have craft brewers, professional commercial craft brewers in the U.S. though, brewing some of these European styles using like North American ingredients. And just to save money or because they don't appreciate the difference. And that it's unfortunate, I think, when that happens because you have somebody that tastes something and the marketplace is told this is a Belgian blonde. And it doesn't have the essence of a Belgian blonde because they're using the wrong ingredients.
Yeah, it could be good, but it won't be exactly the same. Yeah.
So let's turn the tables. What ingredients do you find hard to –
I talked to a guy from Arizona before, and then I realized a problem that we don't have either. About the water, we can have it for a month, a year, maybe. But in Arizona, it's the hot, so hot water, so it can't cool the water down.
Groundwater,
the groundwater,
or the tap water.
It's like
the tap water.
30 degrees Celsius.
Arizona's a
in the water, so
oven. No one should do it. Humans are not. I mean, with all respect to the Native Americans who you know called that their home and found a way, like humans are not intended to live in that kind of climate.
No, but to answer your question, Ben, it's for us. We went to Modern Times the other day, and sure. we tried to clone their IPA, and for us, as we said, the most. The thing that we were probably most worried about was to source hops.
That's what I was thinking, sure.
Yeah, because we are it's no problem for us to source German and Czech hops.
Or New Zealand.
Yeah. But, you know, the American varieties for us, and I have a feeling that, you know, I've been suspicious to the hop markets for so many years, and I get the feeling, you know, that we are so far away from the American... from you know the home country of a lot of these popular hops, and I have a feeling that, you know, my conspiracy is that the hop growers and, you know, the distributors of hop from the U.S. they say, you know, now we send this bad batch to Europe. They have no idea about that because they have no idea how a good hop should taste, you know. So that's been one of my worries, is that the American hops that we get in Europe is not as good as
the ones we might only be getting certain varieties as well, right? Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get the full spectrum.
No, maybe. That
happens with the Tetnang and Hallertauer we get too. Yeah. We're getting the discard pile. Choicest noble hops. Yeah. If you guys have, it's difficult because these are agricultural exports. Yeah. And so different countries have different customs and different tariffs and all that. But there are companies in the U.S., you know, Yakima Valley Hops yeah. is one. We've that ordered, if you can mail order from yeah, them, yeah, you know, yeah, they yeah. it's going to be super fresh. Yeah, and
yeah. We have done that.
So we've done it a few yeah, times, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah just yeah. buy the pound, and they do, you know, sales. They'll email you and tell you when they have the sales. And yeah. I don't know, shipping's probably high, but it's high here too. Yeah, so, yeah.
But like, and it doesn't have to be about the money, but if we order like 5 pounds of hops, even with the customs and the shipping, it's actually more expensive to buy it by like poor quality hops in Sweden.
Yeah,
so it's actually beneficial. Well,
their
to order.
Prices are very good. If you buy by the pound, you know, it's a little over a dollar an ounce. You know, 16 ounces in a pound. Mm. It's a little over a dollar an ounce. And if you go to a homebrew store here, you're paying $2 to $3 an ounce.
Exactly.
And the homebrew store usually opens the bag, repacks it, right. gets oxidized. That might Who knows be how suspect. Old it is?
Sure.
The quality. So hops are one ingredient that I almost exclusively mail order. Yeah. I try to buy everything else local to support the shops. Mm. But the freshness on the hops is so critical. Yeah. And for me, Yakima Valley has been so reliable. They have such a great variety that I always mail order. And then you just vacuum seal the bag back up and you're ready the next time.
That's where we got those South African, right?
Yeah, that's where African they have a lot Queen of South African. They have the Southern New Zealand passion. And they're really delicious. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if we're getting the second because I've only been to New Zealand once. And when I was there, my wife was pregnant, so we didn't do a lot of beer drinking. But you know, I don't. The Nelson that I get from Yakima Valley, the Rewaka that I get from Yakima yeah. Valley is so good
yeah.
that I can't imagine that it's like the discard pile from New Zealand. Because right. if it is, the yeah. New Zealanders are really killing it.
Yeah, but buying in bulk is nothing you do like in the homebrew club, like go together to...
We do that, actually. I'm glad you mentioned that, because one thing that... There's a lot of things that we do that are separate from the meetings. We have social events. You know, we had a club night last week at North Park Beer Company, and people can just come and enjoy beer and socialize. We have campouts where 3 times a year people go and they take a tent or RV and they camp, and we have sit around the campfire, and everyone, a lot of homebrewers are also big into cooking and barbecue. So people share their food and share their beers. And one thing we do is we do what we call club buys, where we'll buy, we've done it with bottles. We've done it with malt.
We had a couple honey buys where we just get
like hundreds and hundreds of pounds of buckwheat, Western buckwheat honey that we then dole out to club members. And usually it's not because of price. It's usually because we can get things that are otherwise not available. We can get
quality.
Bottles like these bottles you can't just buy in a homebrew shop. We call these Vinny Prize. They're like a little, it's a 375 milliliter Belgian bottle that can hold really high carbonation. Mm. But the homebrew stores don't sell these bottles, and you have to buy a whole pallet. Yeah, most like homebrewers can't use a pallet.
Russian River bottles. Like
yes. Well, yes. That's why they're called Vinny Prize, because Vinny Salerzo from Russian River.
Yeah.
But, you know, a homebrewer can't use a pallet. It takes up, you know, in San Diego, your garage is valuable real estate.
Yeah.
But as a club, we buy a pallet. One person stages them for a week, and everyone comes and picks up their bottles. And now everyone's got a case or two of these bottles that we wanted, and that works great. So if you have a critical mass in your homebrew club, you can do things, or you can, you know, get shirts printed, and it brings the average cost down, and you can have club shirts made, or all kinds of things that we've done. That we've done as club buys. I can't even remember all of them, all the things that we've done in the last few years.
We'll do a cider press once a year as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fresh apples to do for the base juice.
Yeah, in September or October.
Typically have like a little competition with that because you know, the club, but we've got enough people to where we've got definitely the foodies, the chef people. We're full of engineers and scientists, but creative, smart people. There's plenty of people that just joined for social. There's plenty of people that are, you know, super into competition brewing. Doug, you know, Jeff, we have dozens in that.
Probably half of our membership either doesn't currently brew or has never brewed.
Okay.
We have maybe a quarter of our membership has never brewed. And then we have another contingent of people that they haven't brewed for years, but they used to brew, or maybe they brew once or twice a year. And then there's probably 30 or 40 of us that brew 10 or more times a year. You know, I probably brew 30 times a year, which is on the higher end, but there's probably 10 of us that brew that many times a year.
My average went up because the last month I brewed like 20 times.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but for a lot of,
for the conference. Yeah. And competition. Yeah.
For a lot of people, the club fills primarily a social purpose. that it's just a group of people that they enjoy being with.
Like-minded.
Makers. We're all makers.
Yeah.
And so I found, I recently got into woodworking, and I found through the club, like multiple other people in the club that are also into woodworking.
Yeah.
And
we got cheesemakers. We got,
we have a lot of cheesemakers. We have salsa makers. The guy who gave the salsa talk today is a club member.
Mm-hmm.
Anything fermented, you're going to find tons of people who did the kombucha thing, the sourdough thing.
An easy one we have, and what do you, the running joke is the brain trust, but if you send out an email, like a question that you have, I did it a couple weeks ago. I had a bag of hops, and it was Zomba, and I was just curious. I got it, and I was just curious if anybody had used it, and I sent it out. You know, has anybody used this? Is it positive or negative? And Brad, who's here, sent within 10 minutes, sent a note to everybody, so all 300, 280 on the list.
Yeah.
So, you know, I couldn't have been the only person that was curious on that hop variety.
Mm.
But within 10 minutes, Brad had, I got that on tap right now. I had a smash beer with Zomba, and it's got these attributes. It's super cool, and that's a layup. Sometimes it's much more elaborate with a recipe or anything
Whatever
like that.
Random question you put out on the quaff list, there's like almost always somebody who knows the answer. It's amazing. I mean, it's a critical mass of people, but it's also people who are like-minded in the sense that people just want to help. It's a group of people that have usually received help from others in the club, and they want to help. And before I forget, another thing I want to say for your listeners, that's one of the things I really appreciate about the club. I'm speaking from an American perspective. Again, I don't know how it is in Sweden, but in America particularly, it seems like over the last 10 years, people have become more compartmentalized. People congregate with folks who have similar career trajectories, that come from similar kinds of communities, similar demographics, similar political views. And it's easy to become very cloistered and say, you know, somebody who went to professional school and got a graduate degree in something, almost everyone in their social circle also went to professional school and got a graduate degree. Or someone who has a blue-collar job, almost everyone in their social circle also has a blue-collar job. And through the Homebrew Club is something that really cuts across all of those dimensions. And there's people in our club that are air conditioning repair person and plumbers and military and dentists and real estate brokers. And I'm an attorney, and we've got people who are physicians and people who are teachers and, you know, commercial real estate managers and just, it cuts across all that. You get people that come from all different parts of the country. San Diego is a city where a lot of people live here that didn't grow up here. So we've got club members. Ben's from Maryland. I'm from South Carolina. We got upstate New York. We got the Pacific Northwest. And you really get a cross-section of people. You get just – and you share this bond, right, over making fermented alcoholic beverages, which, you know, it's funny. It's cool. But, like – that brings people together. And I think there's a lot of value in interacting with people that sort of live in different worlds on a day-to-day basis than you live in, particularly where you share something that brings you together. And
absolutely,
we don't get together at Quaff and like talk about politics and that kind of stuff. And if we did, it would probably be a problem because it would be a dividing thing. But I think it's one of the things, at least in my life, that like binds me with people that live in these other worlds that I wouldn't otherwise interact with. And I really value those interactions, those relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to that point, that's why we have members kind of across the country or you know, we have a member that it got transferred. He's in the Navy. He's in Poland. But people come here, and it's a transitional city for some people. But they go, and they're still members. So we have a member in Texas and Colorado and Connecticut and all over. So
Guam for a while.
Yeah. So
I think there's somebody in Hawaii currently.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing thing. And that's just, you know, I think that's one of the things that we do appreciate, where you can just ask a question. And we're you know, several of us that are in competitions, and I'm more recent to that group, but they'll be more than happy to help you. Even though we are competing against each other, I'll bust, you know, Doug's chops about beating him in a competition, but I know he makes excellent beer, so it's kind of like a one-up, but there's no doubt that, you know, he would help source anything, answer a question or whatever. And that's, I think that's the core of who who we are.
And that's the that's one of the not a problem, but it's a problem with our podcast as well, that we try to help brewers and then they beat us.
Yeah.
Well, that's the highest honor, right? Yeah, for the pupil to beat the teacher is the highest honor that you can receive as a teacher.
And I mean,
like, seriously, you know, I'm somebody who's had some success in competition and I do a lot of mentoring. And the proudest I would be if somebody that I mentored as a new brewer were to win like a national medal. If I'm in the same category, all the better. Now they can teach me something.
Yeah. Yeah.
There were several gold and silver medalists in the Swedish champions that said that they wouldn't get a medal if it wasn't for our podcast. So
that's the highest praise, man. That's congratulations. Yeah. That's,
but it's negative for us.
Well, you want that medal. I get it. Like, you want that medal. Once you get that medal, you'll feel a little differently.
Yeah, because
I really enjoyed this Svartbier.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
That was one of the villains that was very good on the exam. Doug made that.
Nothing weird to it. It's just a straight Schwarz beer.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know who Horst Dornbusch is.
Yeah.
Horst Dornbusch wrote a book on dark lagers. That's a phenomenal book, and that recipe was heavily inspired by things I learned from his book.
Is that the one he wrote with Thomas Weimann?
Yes. Yeah. It came out about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's an outstanding book.
Yeah.
One of the best beer books I've read.
I don't think I actually have it. I met Thomas Weimann once because I won a competition and I had to go to I got to go to Weimann's and brew a collab.
I had to go to Bamberg.
Is that in Munich? You went to
Bamberg.
Bamberg.
Outside Bamberg. It was my first trip to Bamberg.
They let you clean the mash tun.
No. It was like I won with an American barley wine.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I said to them, "Yeah, we're gonna brew your recipe." And I said, "I can't go to Bamberg and get to brew on a Kaspar Schultz brew house with three German brewmasters and brew a barley wine."
Well, you could decoct it. You could do a decoctor of it and put some Rauschmalt in there.
I want to brew something German. You know, I can't go there. And brew my recipe is going to be awkward in one way. So we brewed something, but it was one kind of experience. And Thomas Weimann walked around there pointing with his whole hand and saying stuff. I don't know.
What do they think? What do the environment people think about barley wine? Do they think it's an abomination?
This guy, he was pretty down to earth, the brewmaster, right? Because he used to live in South Korea, so he was kind of inspired by
where did he live in Jeju-do? Jeju Island?
No, I had no idea where in South Korea he lived. But he lived, I think he had a South Korean wife, and they moved back to Bamberg, and he got a job there as a brewmaster at there.
Did he have a brewery in Korea?
No, he just, I think he was employed.
I asked because I've spent some time in Korea. There was a brewery down in Jeju that was, the brewmaster was a German.
All right, yeah.
I was wondering if, and I think it recently closed, so I was wondering if it was
no idea. This was a couple of years ago, so 2016, I think I was there. Yep. Should we close it up?
Yeah. So tomorrow is club night, and we will for sure visit you in your booth.
Yeah.
Or excellent. In your bar.
Bring your liver.
Yeah. We will probably bring some of our own beers for you guys to taste.
Can't wait to try.
I'll have to bring some of my smoked Hellas. I got a couple bottles left.
Yeah.
Okay. Simon will bring his. Is it a smoked Hellas or is it a?
No, it's a classic Bamberg, more Märzen style.
Märzen, okay.
And I noticed that this double IPA that we passed around for the second time now, you've kind of been avoiding it. It's not mine. I'm not going to be offended. I'm just curious.
This was on the exam as well.
Yeah, I'm just curious what kind of character you get from
there was
it.
A split. There was a split.
It was a very polarizing beer.
I was actually thinking about if it was some smoke malt in it. I think it has some.
So one descriptor that some people used was tire fire.
Plastic phenos.
Yeah, what's your descriptor for it? It's not my beer, and I won't say the name of whose beer it is. So I won't be offended.
It's kind of hot, higher alcohols a little bit.
It's about 8.5% alcohol.
Yeah, so it's not boozy, but also maybe kind of a marmalade tone to it, more like cooked citrus oranges more than fresh oranges. so maybe a little bit oxidized. I don't know.
But a very special taste.
Yeah, it's.
I think.
To me, it smells like poop.
All right.
It's a dank, dank.
It smells like. You know what durian is?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Do you like durian?
I never tried it.
You can take a trip to the Philippines.
Yeah, I know what it is, but to me, it's kind of sweet. Yeah. As well.
So I did put two sugar tabs in the bottle. Yeah.
So residual. Yeah.
So that's
what would be perceived as residual.
I was hoping we'd get some good descriptors out of him, but he's being coy.
Yeah. You'd rather drink this Schwarzbier.
You'd rather drink this Schwarzbier.
Yeah.
Good European.
I enjoy the lemon lime Hefeweizen as well.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean,
super refreshing.
Yeah. Guy comes all the way to San Diego from Europe. Discards the IPA and drinks the Schwarzbier.
We had some really good IPAs yesterday, though.
Well, you'll have some Sparrow, too.
If you went to Pizza Port, you had as good as it gets, as far as I'm concerned. And the cool thing about Pizza Port is...
I had a red IPA. That's you rarely see red IPAs in Sweden. And, you know, when you hit that great balance between malt and classic sea hops, for me, that's, you know, it's amazing. I think, you know, that's
their IPAs, they usually do it's like Swami's and what's that on there?
Well, they got Shark Attack. It's a red IPA.
That's the red IPA.
But the thing about Pizza Port that you may not know or appreciate is that almost everything on that board when you walk in and order a beer is like a one-off. Mm-hmm. They have maybe four things that they brew on any kind of regular basis, but in those pubs, everything they do is like just somebody has an idea and they give their brewers a lot of creativity. And I've been to Pizza Port more times than I can count. I've had probably hundreds of beers from there, and I can't remember one that was ever not great. Mm-hmm. And these are all one-off beers, and it's just so impressive to me as a local. You get this amazing variety going there and get something different every time. For you coming from out of town, it doesn't, you know, whether it's a one-off or a staple, you don't necessarily know. But you walk into Pizza Port any given day, and it's something brand new, and it's always going
to
be good.
It's more of what mood you're in to what you want to drink. Because they'll hit some Belgians. They'll do, obviously, when I go there, I drink the IPAs. I mean, that just hits spots for me.
It's the heart and soul of the San Diego brew scene. So many breweries in San Diego have been seeded or founded by people that started at Pizza Port. Yeah. I can't say enough positive things about that place.
Yeah, I guess we haven't heard so many people talking about West Coast IPAs as we have had here in the last few days, in 15 years or...
It's a point of pride here. Yeah, I mean, we're very proud of them, and I still think it's like the best American beer, West Coast. We even sometimes here call it San Diego style IPA. San Diego style IPA is even a little drier than West Coast. You know, West Coast is that fairly dry, clean fermentation, Chico strain, hop bomb. But the San Diego, we like it real dry.
Well, formerly with some caramel in there. Now it's...
No, not here. Caramel's disfavored. Maybe a little Munich if you want. Yeah. But we like it real clean, hop showcase.
Yeah, we were... Before we went to Pizza Port yesterday, we were at North Park Brewing.
Yep.
And we had the Hop Foo.
Kelsey has a talk during the conference. He's a Quaff member. Awesome dude.
Okay, the Denny Kong collab.
Yeah, and also Pliny the Elder. We had those three beers.
Oh, Pliny's amazing.
Yeah. So
do you know the story? Do you know the legend of Hop Foo?
No, I tried to contact Kyle before coming here.
Kelsey?
Kelsey. Yeah. About, you know, doing... just about the Hop Foo, because I saw that he won. I found all talks from homebrew cons that he had about talking on how to brew the best West Coast IPA, that, you know, his goal about brewing the best, and how he did it at home, and he won NHC like 3 years in a row, and then he opened North Park, took Hop Foo with him, and won the Great American Beer Fest two years in a row, I think.
So he was a Quaff member. He still is a Quaff member. Yeah. And from roughly 2010 to 2015, accomplished something that I don't think will ever be accomplished again, which is for 5 or 6 consecutive years, won a medal with the same beer. And not only the same beer, but it was the same IPA, which is one of the most competitive categories. And sometimes he entered it as an IPA, sometimes as a double IPA.
Right.
I think the last year it was as like a chili beer because he added chilies to it. But just incredible run of success on a homebrew level with Hop Foo. 2015 at the Homebrew Con here in San Diego, he gave a soup to nuts, open kimono. I guess that's not politically correct anymore, but he just gave the full... history of how he derived it, everything he did step by step by step, the water treatment, the hops, every stage.
Even bottling, I think.
Legend, you know, all the way up to bottling. Yeah. You know, the Kelsey fill is like when you see a bottle that has the high fill. He taught people that. And now in competition, like a fourth of what you see is the Kelsey fill.
Yes.
You go with the Kelsey fill. If you have a Blickman bottling gun, you do the Kelsey fill. Just a legendary home brewer. And then the guy goes pro around, I think their brewery opened around 2017-ish, North Park Beer Co. And now he's won countless World Beer Cup and GABF medals with this with the hop food that continues to evolve. He continues to improve it. It's just absolutely, it's easily the most decorated IPA of the last decade. Yeah. It's just incredible.
And it seems, and that's one of the good things to see, that people still are, you know, this open source, you know, that I think is one of the most beautiful things about being a homebrewer, that most homebrewers are open source, you know, that
I was talking with, and
to keep that as a professional brewer, it's, you know, it's respect, I would say.
I was talking with Kelsey last week and we were talking about Homebrew Con, and he said he unfortunately wasn't going to be able to make it because he just came from World Beer Cup and has been busy, but I mentioned to him, you know, his 2015 talk was still legend. And he said, you know, actually, I'd love to make a new talk about new things I've learned since then, and volunteered to come to one of our homebrew club meetings and talk about it. And this is a guy who works really hard and who reads and consumes tirelessly on the cutting edge of research and tries all these techniques. And I'm sure many of them don't work and some of them do. And he selects those and he's willing to just come, you know, and volunteer to take his time and come to our club and tell us the selected things that work, so that we can go all and do them and tell everybody else.
It's save a shitload. It's
But that's the culture. And that's what you get from a homebrew club. If you develop a culture of sharing and educating, it just really can rise all boats, lift all boats.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Vinny's was a member of Quaff before they
and part of the same culture. Vinny has also been very
But he got kicked out, or no, he moved.
He moved to NorCal. Down here we call it NoCal, but up there they call it NorCal. He moved. He came from Temecula, and I think his family was in the wine business, and he moved up to north of the Bay Area. If you ever have a chance, maybe while you're in California, go up there to Santa Rosa or Windsor, and
I've been there a few times. It was fantastic.
You got the flight board with 20 and you did them all?
No, not 20. I don't remember. I had also a wonderful dry stout that is one of my favorite styles.
So, that's the thing, right? They're known for these like sours and Belgians and like their IPAs.
Yeah.
But then you go up there and they'll have a stout that you've never heard of that you drink and you're like, oh my God, this is an amazing stout.
Yeah.
Or then you try their STS pills and you're like, this is one of the best American-made pilsners I've ever had. And the things they're known for, they're great at. I'm not trying to say those things are not also great, but they just really across the board had the commitment to excellence.
Yeah,
I think Pliny the Elder is such an icon, and it's such an old beer, but we drank it yesterday and it's
so make
perfect.
Sure to get
still,
some blind.
It doesn't go out of style.
No.
Make sure to get some blind pig water here too.
It's got the piney, grapefruity, citrusy. It doesn't have the whiz bang of all the new crazy hops with the tropical poo notes and you know, diesel fumes. I love a lot of those hops. Yeah. I'm not trying to disparage.
No, potty,
but
no
as one in, we interviewed before in Sweden a time ago, he said that hops that that taste hops, not that think it's a fucking peach.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then you got the Germans who would look at even the hops that we say the grapefruit and piney, and they would say, well, that's heresy, right? It's supposed to taste like spice and herbal and noble in quality. And they would look at Cascade as being a newfangled contraption. We look at Cascade as being like a grandfather on the deathbed, but I love Cascade. Again, not trying to disparage, but that's how quick things move in this game.
Yeah,
great. We can sit here talk all night, it feels like, but I think we should wrap it up, maybe. And
thanks.
We'll join you next week in Stockholm.
Yeah, in Gothenburg, you know.
I wish.
Okay. Yeah, we're in Gothenburg. Stockholm, we can't help you out.
No.
Come to Gothenburg and we'll help you out.
Gothenburg?
Gothenburg, yeah.
Yeah, on the west coast.
On the west coast.
Second biggest city.
Yeah, it's like it's Sweden's San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beer capital of Sweden.
West Coast. Absolutely. I thought the West Coast was Norway.
North of Sweden.
So some part. We have a West Coast in Sweden as
North Pole and shit.
Yes, so thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ben and Doug, for taking your time.
Thank you.
I guess you're really busy. Super nice to talk to you. And talk to you. Listen. You will listen to us some more.
Yes.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Enjoy your time in San Diego.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Hallelujah.
Vi är iväg på club night.
Yeah. Vi har på oss clubkläderna.
Exakt.
Tantbrun t-shirt.
Tantbrun t-shirt med. Represent. Tantbrun.
Det här är jag taggad på.
Det här ska bli svinkul. Vi ska ju ha med oss inspelningsutrustningen, men vi kan ju inte riktigt... det kan ju bli lite stojigt, va? Men åtminstone så vill vi ju försöka då snacka igen här med Doug och Ben och bjuda lite på våran öl och kanske dricka lite av deras öl igen då.
Och se om vi hittar något jävligt spännande.
Ja, men precis. Några goa pajsar liksom.
Ja, som vi kan snacka med. Både god öl och höra dem berätta om sin öl kanske. Ja. Om vi kan få något sånt.
Ja, det ska bli, vi måste lite kolla vad
det
gör för öl.
Jag hoppas att liksom. Bob från Chicago är där. Peter från Long Island.
Peter från Long Island.
Våra polare.
Våra homies.
Våra homebroomies. Ja, det är skitbra.
Ja, let's go!
Let's go!
It's! Yeah!
So this is, you can see the...
We should start... are we recording?
Yeah. Do you know who learned me?
You should have that microphone.
That looks like a Kelsey Phil.
That's a Kelsey Phil.
Kelsey McNair Phil. Beautiful.
Magnus, you should have the microphone to your mouth.
Yeah, it's a beautiful Kelsey McNair Phil in the wild. Cheers.
Cheers. So this is my standard saison. I usually brew with...
thank you.
80% Pilsner, 10 Vienna and 10 wheat. This is shit wheat flakes, so it's under-modified wheat flakes.
Shit wheat?
Yeah. And this is a new Pilsner malt from... Best malts, so it's an old like Barke, but it's even older. It's called Alexis, the barley variety.
And is this a? It smells, the aroma profile. It profiles like DuPont. Is this a 565 or equivalent?
This is a mix with DuPont strain and Juvaru, the Lithuanian brewery.
Yeah, it has that peppery DuPont character. It's, the aroma is outstanding, and the presentation. This huge pillowy head that just keeps refreshing with lace on the glass. I'm excited to try it.
And I learned from, you know who Avery Swanson is, keeping together. It's a Saison brewer here in the U.S. And she taught me that if you want to use spices, you should add them to the bottle and not into the fermenter. So I make when I re-ferment, I make a slurry with sugar and water and spice. So this is spiced with batak pepper, which is like a Sichuan pepper, but from Indonesia. So
I'm not familiar with that one.
No. And I wasn't either, but I tasted it and it tastes like orange marmalade. You know.
Yeah, I think it's quite fruity.
This is a really outstanding saison.
It is, yeah.
Bone dry, effervescent, great phenols. The peppery character. There's some esters that give it some impression of sweetness up front. Really, I mean, this is a 40 plus point saison easily.
It is, yeah.
Nice, really outstanding.
Because my only, you know, what I would tweak with it, it was maybe up the bitterness.
Yes.
Yeah.
You do anything, bump the bitterness up by 10 to 20%.
Yeah.
It'll help give you a little more Christmas, although this is very crisp as it is.
Yeah.
But this is phenomenal.
It is. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and that malt character really comes through. I mean, this is a yeast-driven beer, obviously, but the malt character is... very fresh.
Yep.
So it, you know, I score one for Lodo. I'm intrigued.
Yep.
You are not going to sleep tonight, Magnus.
Yeah, I'm super happy.
Tomorrow.
I mean, this is good enough to medal.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Saison is a very difficult category because it's very broad and the judging is can be somewhat subjective.
Or
the aroma on this is, you know, most judges are trained. The first Saison that's a classic that many have had is DuPont.
Yep.
And immediately on the aroma, this just reeks of DuPont.
Yep.
So I think that's to your advantage because they're going to expect that kind of character likely.
All right.
But you have a really nice balance of the esters and phenols. So no one's going to say it's too much of one, too much of the other. I mean, this has a very real chance of meddling.
Yeah.
Very real.
I'm excited.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the glass, I mean, it's just leaving sheets.
For me, that's process, you know.
And for a beer very little residual sugar, this is not coming from dextrins. This is all process on your proteins. Yeah. So this is, that's a, yeah, very well done.
Mm. Yeah, you're happy with that,
That's a tough act to follow.
Magnus. You look proud, Magnus.
I'm pretty proud, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty proud.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So
we know that you can brew the recipe, good Saison.
You just kind of told me, you know, 80% of your Pilsner that's not quite the Barca, but close.
Any
Pilsner.
Vienna, 80 Pilsner, 10 Vienna, and 10 wheat shit malt from Chateau. I really love that.
And if you can't get that, what would you take instead if you can't find the shit malt?
Unmalted wheat, unmalted. Unmalted barley or barley flakes or something like that, I would say,
I mean, that's a lot of your proteins, probably.
For me, you know, it's first you learn to brew good beer, and then you learn to brew good-looking beer. And, you know, and head retention and a good foam is, you know, for me it's important. You know?
I think that's good advice.
Yeah.
Because a lot of, you know, we drink with our eyes first.
Yeah, all right, exactly.
But when you're brewing, you need to start with taste first, and then the eyes are a luxury.
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Okay, so next beer, this is not in the competition. I wanted to bring something that I brewed myself, obviously. So
cheers.
I grabbed a bottle of Oud Bruin that I made like 3 years ago, I think.
How do you say that in English?
Oud Bruin.
Oud Bruin, yeah.
Oud Bruin. And it was really good when I brewed it.
Tack.
Now it's 3 years old, so maybe it has gained from lagering.
It doesn't smell
lagering.
Old. Yeah, it doesn't smell old. It still has some freshness.
Yeah. Yeah, like sour beers quite often. They stand the time good.
Yeah, Brettanomyces is an excellent antioxidant in that way.
Yeah, and there's a distinct sour cherry note, plenty of Brett character. Mm. You get a little bit of that boot leather, barnyard funk.
Yeah.
Slight citrusy note. I'd say it's slight orange peel note. And also some... just very light hints of strawberry. I'm guessing that's probably ester profile or...
Maybe, yeah.
Just some, you know, some soft fruit. It could be cantaloupe. I mean, there's just a very soft fruit essence. But that, yeah, the cherry and the barnyard are sort of most prominent.
Yeah.
And some malt richness behind it, bread crust. Yeah, it's acid forward, bone dry. But the acidity is not bracing.
It's a bit too dry, I would say, for a Oud
Bruin. For an Oud
Bruin,
you'd want a little bit more residual body, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, this one, it's 3 years that Brett's going to keep working in the bottle.
But honestly, I think it's quite tasty.
It's drinkable.
It's extremely drinkable. Yeah. It's delicious. Yeah, this is also very delicious.
Thank you.
But what does the... Because one of my... I don't remember, you know, the style profile, but the oak, I can't taste that much oak in it, and I'm not supposed... If there should be any oak in
Oud Bruin. Yeah, so Oud Bruin is typically fermented in steel.
All right.
Yeah. So Oud Bruin, like oak, is not characteristic in an Oud Bruin.
No, it's when you do the red Flemish beer, they should be oaked.
Yes.
But the Oud Bruin should be not oaked.
Yeah, those are fermented in steel.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love steel, man.
I love steel.
Cool. Should we... cool. Nice. Should we do the Rauch beer?
Yeah, I'm going to sip and savor this Odbrun for a minute here, too.
There is
it's very nice complexity in this. I mean, there's a lot of depth to the fermentation character. Yeah. A really nice blend of phenols, esters, and Brett character.
Thank you. I'm a bit flattered.
You know, and you still have some malt that shines through. I think probably 2 years ago, before the Brett had dried this completely out, you probably had a little bit more malt supporting it. Mm. And in an Odbrun, you know, some of that malt being a little bit more prominent would be welcome. But this is very enjoyable as it is.
Do you get a lot of European, like, this style of beer, like Rodenbach and stuff like that? Is that, like, common in the
like
U.S.?
Two or three examples that we can find. You know, you find the Rodenbach Grand Cru, or, you know, in Flanders Red, you find the Duchess de Bourgogne, you find the Cuvée de Jacobins. You know, there's two or three that you can find, and then the rest are difficult to find. And you can find craft examples that are very hit or miss, mostly miss.
Okay.
But when you find the hits, it's enjoyable.
Yeah.
Okay, here comes the Rauch.
Yes.
Give me a tiny bit. I'm going to swish, and then we're going to give it a fair chance because the sour can.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I got some bacon on that.
Yeah, this is I'm really into smoked beer. So here I have I'm going to show you a picture.
Oh, yeah.
I smoked the malt here.
It's a big green egg, but it's red.
Exactly. It's a red egg then. Yeah. It's a
socialists in Sweden.
I don't remember. I don't remember.
It's the red was more communism, but
I think it's an American brand also.
Oh,
but
big green egg is American.
Yeah, but
the
red's, I think,
a knockoff. Yeah,
like in something Joe. I don't remember. But so I smoked the beer myself. I smoked the malt. Yeah, of course. I put it here in this pipe here. Put some net in the bottom, and then put in the malt here in this pipe.
Who's that looking in there, sucking down all the
CO2? That's me.
Oh, that's you.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even recognize it with your do-rag.
So I did this. I smoked it in, I think it was in January, February, or something, and smoked it with beechwood.
Yeah, it smells like beechwood. I mean,
yeah.
There's a really nice bacon character to this that doesn't come across as oily or excessive, but comes across, actually, I mean, it comes across like some of the finer bacon. So you can buy now like craft bacon. There's a place in Kentucky called Benton's Bacon, for instance, that you can get bacon shipped to you, and this has, you know, a distinct wood character to it, but it's different than the mass-produced bacon that has kind of a liquid smoke kind of character. You can really get the wood out of it, and that's what this smells like.
But is it common to smoke bacon with beechwood, or is that, you know, the most common?
I don't think we really have a lot of beechwood in the U.S. A lot of people smoke with oak.
All right, yeah.
Oak is a really common thing that people use to smoke here. But the beechwood is nice because it's a little bit softer.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the oak is a little bit more coarse, a little bit more harsh.
More hickory maybe also here in barbecue. Hickory.
Smoking a lot of hickory. And, you know, here in the Southwest, you get mesquite.
Yeah,
which has a really cool character, very, very unique. This is a really nice combination of that smoke, but also the malt sweetness. Like, in the aroma, there's significant suggestions of sweetness that almost, because a lot of bacon these days, you know, they'll put maple syrup or they'll do some glaze. And the sweet suggestions on this really remind of, like, a slightly sweetened bacon. That's a really, really nice profile. Along with a little bit of melanoid richness. I mean, you can tell that there's Munich malt in here.
Yeah, there's Munich malt, Cura Munich 2, and some Cura aroma. I think it's...
The aroma's outstanding. I don't remember... This doesn't smell like one of the beers that I judged on Wednesday.
Okay.
I judged this category, but there were three panels. And I think that I would probably have remembered. So you probably won't get a score sheet from me. It'll be one of the other judges.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But this smells outstanding. This smells... I haven't tasted it yet, but it smells like something that would really have gotten me interested.
Okay, good. I had a gold ribbon
in the first round.
So,
You know, there's almost... I'm not getting any hop, which is fine. Maybe a touch of herbal. But there's almost like a tea-like suggestion. Which actually, I did have a beer on Wednesday that had a white tea. Like, this might have, maybe I spoke too soon. I may have judged this.
Okay.
Let me taste it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I judged this.
Okay.
And I might have written on the score sheet to send me the recipe because okay. this has that white tea-like right.
yeah.
impression that really struck a note with me on Wednesday. I'll make an ass of myself if that's not true, but this has a almost unmistakable profile. I mean, that wood yeah. comes through big time. And in a way that sometimes with smoked beers, you get more of the, you know, soot part of the smoke and less mm-hmm. of the wood part of the smoke. This is a lot more of the wood part of the smoke, yeah. which is...
Yeah, you know, there's quite a lot of... it's quite... almost too rough, I think. It's almost too smoky.
Well, you get a little bit of... You know, you get a little bit of the ash or yeah. smoke in the yeah. aftertaste. It fades yeah. out. But the aroma is so intriguing, so inviting.
Yeah.
Really a wonderful beer. And yeah. I mean, the bitterness balance in this is perfect. I mean, it's right yeah. down, you know, you got medium, maybe slightly medium plus intensity on your melanoid and, yeah. you know, malt character, and your bitterness is exactly in line with that. And the smoke is maybe just a touch higher to sort of show itself off, but not enough to overbalance. Yeah. And the balance is really well done on this.
Thank you.
So
thank
did you do like... Did you try different amounts of your smoked malt to really get that balance, or did you just get lucky?
No, mostly just lucky. I buy a Weyman smoked malt.
Because this is not 100% smoked malt. You're blending this.
Yeah, I'm blending it. Yeah. You need a melanoid and the Munich character also. I think that with caramel, with this Car Munich 2 and Cararoma, that's also a darker caramel malt from Germany, it's the combination with the smokiness that gives this sausage flavor.
Yeah.
That if you only have the smoke, you don't get that. But together with this caramel flavors and tastes, then you get all those sausages.
Well, because what happens to meat when you cook it? Uh-huh. Melanoidin reactions yeah, on yeah, the outside of the yeah, meat, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
the same melanoidin reactions yeah. that are happening on the outside of the meat are what you're getting from that malt, which yeah. is what gives it that character, that overall yeah. profile that reminds you of sausage.
Yeah.
I think the most you know the cool thing about your beer is that you buy Weyman's smoked malt
yeah.
and then you smoke it again. It's both genius and stupid in the same time in one way. It's like
double smoked.
Yeah, it's double smoked. Yeah.
Starbucks DDS. Has a product called double smoked bacon.
Yeah,
beer. It's genius. You know? It's for me. It's
DDS, it's bro.
Yeah. DDS IPA.
You got that DDS Ralph beer, bro?
It's fucking crazy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So if we represent the Swedish homebrew scene, what's your impression of
outstanding, dude? If you guys represent, I mean, we're averaging a 40 here. Like, if yeah. you guys, if this represents, but yeah. you go, I mean, you guys are not the average Swedish homebrewer. Like, you can't be.
Maybe not.
But
if you should are, be obvious,
then I'm super impressed.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And someday I'll come like see the Northern Lights and sleep in an igloo.
Have some snooze.
Yeah, 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 you guys do that shit that's like the fermented shark that's disgusting or whatever?
Yeah.
Iceland, I think. Oh, that's Iceland.
The pea shark. The pea, you know?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
They dig...
It's good for a man.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But it's pea in it, you know? I don't eat pea.
You guys do the... what's it? The meatballs?
With the meatballs and
the furniture.
And we have the fermented herring. We have, which is like... it's in some countries, it's like a biowarfare product, but we eat that shit, you know.
Well, we eat fucking Cheetos.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Super pleased to have you on here, Doug. And thank you for taking your time.
Thanks for the beers, and
this has been an awesome event, the Homebrew Con.
Amazing.
I hope you have a good time in San Diego. It's really a pleasure to have you guys here. I've enjoyed my time. Yeah. These beers are wonderful. I mean, these are really, really good. I'm glad to be able to try these.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you're welcome to Sweden anytime. Just give us a ring.
Yeah. Cheers. I will. I mean, a couple of small kids, international travel, will have to wait a few years until they're old enough for... how long was your trip here? Probably 15 hours?
More like 36 with all the stopovers.
Well, then we have
pretty bad trip.
yeah.
But you should come now, because later you have to pay for your kids' travel tickets as well. If you go now, then
yeah, exactly.
The travel
one of
free.
Them is free at least. Yeah. 3-year-old's not. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But they're both big demons on the
air. Yeah. It's been an experience having you try our beers.
Yeah. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. Like, these are legitimately extremely good, and I won't be surprised at all if your saison takes a medal. It's very deserving, and the smoke beer is also, so unique. Very capable of winning a medal as well. And, your Oldbrunn probably a year or two ago would have been, and even as it is, it's still very, very fun to drink.
Yeah. That's nice to hear. Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. Should we do it?
Yeah.
Hallelujah!
Skål!
Yeah.